May it please the court, I am Andrew Lowe, counsel for the appellant, Comcast Corporation, and if possible, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly.
The principal issue in this appeal is whether At Home Corporation fell within the insurance policy's definition of a minority-held organization. Comcast wins this issue because the relevant language in the policy is ambiguous. The policy defines an MHO as an organization which Comcast owns 5% or more of the common stock, the outstanding common stock. This is an arithmetical calculation, one number divided by another number. As we've shown in the briefs, that the result of that calculation can vary day by day as the number of outstanding shares varies. Therefore, the issue of whether Comcast owns 5% of the stock of any particular company, the answer to that calculation is different depending on when the calculation is performed. But, and this is critical, the policy language does not tell us on what date the calculation is to be performed. And therefore, since the central question on this point is not answered by the policy is ambiguous. Now, the rule in Pennsylvania is that ambiguities in a policy are construed against the drafter. And it is undisputed in this case that the relevant policy language here was drafted by National Union. Therefore, this ambiguity that we've identified must be construed against the insurers and in favor of Comcast, producing coverage of Comcast losses. Now, the insurers, of course, argue to the contrary, but their arguments in many cases actually support Comcast's position. For example, one of the things that the insurers do throughout their briefs is they try to paraphrase the actual language of the policy. And I don't fault them for doing that. They're not trying to mislead anybody. But in trying to explain what it means, they use different language. And when they do this, they invariably insert language in their explanation which conveys a concept of time. Words like when or whenever or as long as. And I'll give you an example. On page 17 of the National Union brief, when they're explaining what they think the meaning of the key policy language is, they say the policy, quote, provides automatic coverage whenever Comcast owns a 5 to 50% voting interest. Well, there's one small problem with that. The word whenever does not appear in the actual policy.
Let me ask you, Mr. Lowe, they start by focusing on different language, which I think, and I'll just share with you, it tends, I think, to support their position, but I want to hear your response. The language they talk about and they say and you never respond to is this respective capacities language. It provides coverage for alleged wrongful acts in their respective capacities as directors or officers of such minority held organizations. As I understand their argument, it is that has to mean that the wrongful act occurs at the time the company's an MHO, because if it's not, they were not acting in their capacity as an officer or director of MHO. How do you respond to that?
I thought we responded, but perhaps not. Your Honor, that is a circular argument. It's very clever, but ultimately it fails as a matter of logic. They're right that the policy provides that a claim arising from a wrongful act is covered if performed by a director of an MHO, and therefore that the company must be an MHO at the time of the wrongful act. But the question, that framing the question that way assumes the answer to the ambiguity that we have presented. That is the company in fact an MHO? And how do we know that? And the way we know that is by going to the definition to see whether Comcast owns 5%, but 5% when. According to our best reading of the policy, if Comcast owns 5% of a company, either before or on the inception date of the policy, or after if they acquire the interest later, then it becomes an MHO at that date. And here's the key thing. Nothing in the policy says that that status ever changes if the share ownership were to dip below 5%. And there are excellent reasons, which I can get into, as to why that makes perfect sense. And this is not just some kind of, you know, lawyer talk. It's, you know, some strange technicality. Quite the contrary. This definition of MHO is derived from and based on the insurer's own language defining the term subsidiary. If you look at the sentence that defines an MHO, it's 33 words long. 16 of those words are quoted directly from various parts of the definition of subsidiary. No question that when they wrote this definition of MHO, they had the definition of subsidiary in front of them. But the definition of subsidiary has some key provisions in it, which they deleted when they moved over to MHO. In particular, it says that a subsidiary ceases to be a subsidiary if Comcast's ownership percentage in the company drops below 50%. So they know exactly how to specify that there is a limited period of time and that you could become a subsidiary, and then if depending on the ownership percentage, that status can end. And they set it very clearly as to subsidiaries. And
with can I ask you, Mr. Long, I'm sorry, finish your sentence.
But that language was omitted when they went over and wrote the passage on MHO definition.
I apologize for interrupting you. I wanted to ask you about the subsidiary piece because there's something in there that bothers me. I do understand the argument that you're making. You know, why didn't they have the similar termination language? If I understand your position, it's essentially, and correct me please, that if the company, you're looking at the inception, if you're an MHO at inception, you stay in MHO throughout the policy term. Unless somebody becomes an MHO later.
Or earlier.
Fair enough.
Yes.
All right. Under the definition of subsidiary, those terms, as I understand them, there are certain circumstances under which a company can become automatically a subsidiary. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. So if we take the argument that a subsidiary or a company is an MHO at inception, let's say Comcast buys another 45%. 46%, and it becomes a subsidiary. Under your definition, once an MHO throughout the policy, it could be an MHO and a subsidiary at the same time. But as I understand the definition of MHO, it excludes subsidiaries. So, you know, one could argue that that the interpretation you're advancing would be unreasonable because you would get into that quagmire. You can get into a situation where on its face the policy fails. You're looking a little quizzically at me, and maybe I'm not being clear.
Well, perhaps since it's a slightly new twist on what the insurers are arguing, perhaps I didn't.
I don't think anybody argued, but I was curious they didn't. Let me make sure. So my position or my point is, it seems to me that under your position, at some point a company can be an MHO and a subsidiary at the same time. If the company acquired, okay.
Not really, because as you correctly point out, the definition of MHO provides that it can be an MHO so long as it's not a subsidiary. So the MHO status is confined to a space of 45 percentage points from 5 to 50.
But what if Comcast buys another 5%, they buy another 46%. Now under the definition, it's automatically a subsidiary.
Yes, and no longer an MHO.
And where does it say that?
Because the definition explicitly excludes companies that are a subsidiary. It says in so many words that a company is not an MHO if it is in a subsidiary.
Does it make a difference? I mean, the same coverage would apply. They're not getting double coverage. It would be the same coverage.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. It makes no difference.
Under the insurance carrier's interpretation of the contract, and I don't know what the underlying problem was, so maybe I ought to start with that. I don't know whether the underlying problem was a vote on day one or whether it was a series of acts done by the board or by the directors for a period of time involving transactions. But under the insurance company's definition, you would have to do the calculation of the percentage every day to determine whether or not on day one there's coverage, day three there is no coverage, day five there is. Is there a problem with that?
There is a huge problem with that, Your Honor, and that's a large part of our position. That's entirely unreasonable. It's unreasonable to expect that Comcast would have been buying that obligation when it paid almost $1 million for this D&O insurance coverage. Comcast never thought that it had to pick up the telephone every day and call all 61 of its MHOs to find out what the number of shares outstanding was so that they could recalculate their percentage so that they would be forewarned if their share percentage had been diluted to less than 5%.
But the flip side is also true. I mean, you get the benefit if someone happens to, there's dilution somewhere and a company gets to more than 5%, now you've got coverage that you didn't know you had at the beginning. And I'm not sure why that's so terribly unfair. I mean, it's written arguably that it's automatic. If it's under 5%, you don't have coverage. If it's more, you do. And I recognize I understand the argument that you don't really have control if you stay a minority-held organization, because somebody else could dilute you, but it seems like there's ups and downs, and that's what you paid for.
Well, but I think my response to that, Your Honor, is that this is how the insurers wrote it. It was their decision, for instance, not to require Comcast to notify the insurers every time they got over 5% of a company. It's automatic. They don't want to hear about it. Once it goes over, they simply accept the risk. And that's the way they calculated the premium, and that's the way they decided the coverage would be. There's nothing unfair about holding them to that. The only question is, having paid all this money, so the insurance company is already insuring Brian Roberts as a director of At Home Corporation. And then there is an act of dilution, and so the 5%, above 5%, goes to slightly below 5%. So the question is it at all unfair or unreasonable to think that they would continue to cover a risk that they're already covering? That doesn't seem very surprising to me, whereas the notion that we would have to call 61 MHOs every day for 3 years to find out whether we still had coverage, that strikes me as illogical and unreasonable. So given that those are the only two options, it seems to me that our interpretation is better. But, and this is the, so I'm getting close to the end if I'm going to reserve 3 minutes. I think the thought that I'd like to leave you with is that we do not have to show that our interpretation of the policy is superior to the insurer's. We merely have to show that it is one reasonable way. Even if you think their interpretation is more convincing, we still win, as long as the policy is reasonably susceptible to both interpretations. I think we've done that, and I think, therefore, under the rule of construction, it's construed in our favor, and we have coverage. I'm just hitting 3 minutes, so I'm going to stop there for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. 11 minute going first?
Yes.
Would you set the clock for 11 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Tim McDonald on behalf of National Union. May it please the court. If I can address the question that you asked, Judge Roy, and that is the coverage the same for subsidiary and MHO? And I think Comcast Council said it was. In fact, it's not the same. And the reason it's not the same is that subsidiary coverage has coverage for the entity itself for securities claims, which is quite a valuable coverage. And it also has coverage for all the directors and officers on the entire subsidiary, as opposed to the MHO, which is just the ones that are placed at the specific written request.
But as we are here, with only apparently one director, one Comcast officer being a director, it really makes no difference, does it?
Well, I think in terms of what the coverage would be, if At Home became a subsidiary, then At Home itself would have coverage for securities claims.
Okay.
And At Home was sued for millions and millions of dollars.
I got you.
Okay. Make a big difference. If I can address the subsidiary definition, because I think Comcast has it exactly wrong. He said something about, if you count the words, there's 33 in MHO. I trust him on that. And a number of them appear in the definition of subsidiary. Just while he was talking, I got into someone up to 200 words in the subsidiary definition, and I lost count. The structure is completely different because the coverages are different. For subsidiaries of a certain size acquired after the inception date, you have to pay more premium. You have to give particulars to the carrier. It's a completely different structure of coverage. And the language that Comcast ignores is in sub 1, the sub 1 definition, which says an entity becomes a subsidiary if Comcast owns more than 50% on or before the inception date. On or before the inception date is the language they want to read into minority held organization definition, but it's not there. So the doctrine of expres unius that they rely on actually cuts against them. It shows if you want to define it under minority held organization, you can absolutely do it. And they didn't do that. And so the CSIS language is necessary in the subsidiary.
Let me ask you the question, the other question I ask, and that is, under your definition or your interpretation of the provision, coverage could come and go on a daily basis.
Well, this is an abstract argument because and I think Pennsylvania law, like Colorado, says, look, you have to look at it in particular circumstances, the facts, not in a vacuum. And so what we know from the evidence is that they had 83 MHOs over a five-year period, and not one time, none, did it ever fluctuate up and below 5%. Not a single time. They acquired 5% interest, and they stayed above 5%, and then they sold it at a certain time. In every instance, it was once above, and then they're below. This is a sort of hypothetical argument. Well, it could be that one day there's a dilution because someone might exercise a stock option. But we're talking about hundreds of millions of shares issued and outstanding. At Home had over 300 million. Comcast itself has close to 3 billion shares. So this is it's a hypothetical construct because on the facts, it never happened.
But even so, Mr. McDonald, you've asked us, and the court said it's unambiguous, the trial court said, and you're asking us to find it's unambiguous or to so conclude. And Judge Roy's question, so I understand what you're saying about that it's hypothetical, but it's right. The point he's making is right, isn't it? I mean, the fact of the matter is they go up and down automatically. And so they may have coverage on one day, and they may not the next day.
That's right. It is theoretically possible, and what we know from the evidence, and this isn't a case of a personal automobile insurance policy that was handed to the carrier and they accepted it. This was a negotiated policy, and the broker who negotiated the policy on behalf of Comcast, her name was Carolyn Preferis, she testified she understood exactly what this meant in her deposition. She understood that if you didn't own 5%, you didn't qualify. And you had to own 5% at the time of the wrongful act, the very question you asked. There is an absolute element of time in there. A wrongful act committed in the capacity as a director or officer of such MHO.
Well, I think Mr. Lowe's argument, if I understand it, is you start with the definition, and his definition is, and I'm going to shorten it for ease, is MHO on inception date is MHO. So what he would say is this language about capacity that I asked him about was you plug in the definition, and it means that you're an MHO, you are acting in your capacity of a director as a company that's defined as an MHO, which means a company that was an MHO at inception.
Right.
Why? So your argument has to be that's unreasonable. Why is that unreasonable?
It's unreasonable because the on or before the inception date isn't in the definition of MHO. It is in the definition of subsidiary. They could have done that. They could have bargained for that. It's also unreasonable because the broker who negotiated for Comcast. Now, this is startling. I mean, this is saying I disagree with my company, with my client. They had their interpretation is not what we intended when we negotiated this policy. So she said, if you don't own 5 to 50%, it's not an MHO. She understood that. We also know from the record that she communicated with the risk manager of Comcast, Kathleen Koop, and this is at 2675 and 2679 of Volume 1 of the record. This is the beauty of email. As lawyers can come up with theories, but we're stuck with the documents. And what Ms. Koop said is they actually did inquire. They said, here's a particular directorship. Here's a particular officer. Do we have coverage under endorsement 8? In the first instance, this is a 2675, what Ms. Preferis said is, well, it doesn't look like you own 5 to 50%. You don't have coverage. And then she went on to say the entity probably has its own coverage because this is excess coverage. Just like we know At Home had its own coverage and paid Mr. Roberts $3 million in defense costs. And she didn't just stop there. She said, okay, looks like there's no coverage because you don't have the requisite ownership. And we asked her about this in the deposition, and she said, did I care about what the ownership was on the inception date? No, that wasn't relevant to me. It's when the director is serving, because that's when they can commit the wrongful act. And so she then went on to say, if you want coverage, if you're concerned about this, we can go to the carriers and schedule it. We can go and specifically schedule it. And we know they did that in this policy in endorsement 9 for Mr. Roberts' service on Turner Broadcasting. They did it for all the directors of Metro Media in endorsement 4. So they absolutely knew how to do it. They could do it. Their broker said to them, if you care, you can do it. And Mr. Lowe said, oh, we talk about The carriers use this language sometimes only as long as there's ownership. Well, the interesting thing about that language, that comes from their broker in correspondence.
But when you raise all these arguments about what the broker understood and what the risk manager understood, isn't that all to interpret an ambiguity? And you're up here saying there is no ambiguity.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the Pennsylvania cases say that you can, that they've adopted the restatement. This is in the Sunbeam versus Liberty Mutual case. It's a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case from 2001. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, we look at the language, but we don't look at it in a vacuum. And what we ought to do is consider the course of performance and the trade usage and the custom, just like Colorado. You look at that because you're trying to be the meta objective, and that's in all their cases and all of our cases, is to get to the intent of the parties. So I think what it tells us is you look at that, their broker thought the same thing, the course of performance, the communication confirms that there wasn't any confusion, that what we have is the arguments after the fact, because Comcast sees an opportunity to get another $50 million on top of obtaining $1.5 billion that they got in the at-home transaction. I mean, getting back to the particular facts, because the court tells us, don't think about this in the abstract. Here, at-home issued 52 million shares when they acquired Excite. This was the event that dropped them significantly below 5%. It was in May of 99. It didn't catch anyone unaware. This was something that was on the front page of all the newspapers. Excite was the search engine Google of the time in 1999 when they did this. Mr. Roberts, who served on a board of At Home, he understood it. He had to. Everyone understood it. So there's no question about it. If I could just address the alternative grounds the district court ruled with the failure to make a specific written request. And this, they can't argue, is ambiguous policy language. The policy says you only get coverage if there's a specific written request for the director to serve on the board.
Isn't your position that was to protect Comcast, not the insurer?
No, that was how our position had been characterized. That's not our position.
That's not your position.
It's not our position. What that does, it serves, now they say it's meaningless. And let's get back to the principle of expressio unius, because in endorsement 5, they have a similar outside directorship coverage for nonprofits, and they took the specific written request out. Why? Because there's less risk for serving on a nonprofit. But when Comcast makes a specific written request, it is going on record that says our policy is at risk for your service on this outside entity. And so that risk means they've got to manage it, because there's one limit, $50 million. It's got to cover Comcast in case it gets sued. It's got to cover the Comcast directors in case they get sued. So what it does is it serves to mitigate the risk. It's not a meaningless provision.
Can I ask you, Mr. McDonald, Mr. Lowe's side, they argue Brakeman applies here, Pennsylvania Supreme Court case that says you have to look at any prejudice to you all, and I will be very candid with you. I wasn't so moved by your argument of how you were prejudiced. Your response is Ace Limited, says Brakeman's never been applied to a claims policy. I'm just curious, Ace was a Superior Court case, as I recall. Has the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ever commented on or moved away from Brakeman?
I think there's a distinction, and I'm just about out of time, but if I can...
Take your time.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. What the Comcast reply brief raised this issue of, there are two kinds of clauses in Pennsylvania, they say. One is called a, quote, anti-prejudice clause, and the other is other. I don't know what that means. I'm not sure they do. And then they cite a series of cases. There is no such thing in those cases as an anti-prejudice clause. And where the courts have applied the rule of Brakeman is in claims administration after there's coverage. So, failure to cooperate, an allegation there's a failure to cooperate. So there's coverage, but you failed to cooperate. There's coverage, but you didn't get consent to settle. There's coverage, but you didn't file proof of loss. And so that's the situation. Those are all the types of cases which require prejudice. The cases that do not require prejudice are when you have a condition of coverage, something that says, we will cover you if you give written notice, a specific written request that the director serve on this particular MHO. So I particularly in light of the endorsement 5, the nonprofit directorship, I don't see how you can conclude it's a meaningless provision. And any argument about prejudice, it Brayton simply doesn't apply. It doesn't apply because it's not a situation in which you're administering the policy. You're not administering it after there's coverage for a wrongful act. Thank you.
Add about 45 seconds to Mr. Lowe's time, would you please? Mr. Lowe, we're ready to hear from you.
No, we're not. Mr. Engelbretz.
4 minutes.
4 minutes, please.
So soon I get off track.
Okay, please support Kirk Engelbretz on behalf of Federal Insurance Company number 11444. I'd like to address some of the alternative grounds for affirming the district court's summary judgment in favor of the carriers. The first has to do with the exhaustion issue. Federal Insurance Company issued an excess policy to Comcast, a sophisticated insured and a Fortune 100 company. It contained an express condition precedent that the excess policy Federal issued would not be triggered unless it was exhausted, which it specifically defined as the full amount of the underlying limit, defined as $25 million, paid in legal currency under the primary insurance defined as National Union's insurance policy at issue in this case. It's an express condition precedent. It's clear, and under Pennsylvania law, this court is required to enforce it as written. Pennsylvania courts consistently have done so. Even when the insured has settled with the primary carrier for less than the total underlying limit, the Pennsylvania courts say excess coverage is not triggered. And the same is true when the primary carrier becomes insolvent or declares bankruptcy. The excess carrier is not triggered. It's undisputed in this case that the National Union policy, the aggregate limit for all of the coverages, A, B, and on endorsement 8, was $25 million. It's also undisputed that Comcast seeks from National Union in this case less than the full $25 million. They seek $22.4 million. Therefore, there's a delta of $3.6 million that remains to respond to other claims, even if Comcast is awarded everything it seeks from National Union in this case. And it's important to keep in mind that these policies did not just cover Mr. Roberts' service on the at-home board. They provided securities coverage against Comcast, a Fortune 100 company, and all its subsidiaries. It provided coverage for claims against Comcast directors and officers in their capacity as Comcast directors, officers, or their subsidiaries. It also provided coverage for the other 95 different times that Comcast officers and directors served on the boards of the 83 other entities that qualified from time to time as MHOs. So the coverage at issue here really was a small sliver of the coverage provided by these policies. Because $3.6 million remains to respond to those other claims, even a successful result for Comcast in this case will not exhaust the underlying policy and will not trigger the federal excess policy. The excess policy is a source of excess funds, not an alternative source of funds. It would be unfair to give Comcast more coverage than it bargained for and than it paid for. It makes three arguments why the court should ignore the express language and condition precedent in the federal excess policy. The first, you should consider it to be functionally exhausted, relying on the Coppers Authority. That has not been adopted by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and the only Pennsylvania authority on that issue is a lower Pennsylvania court, Hoffman versus Shelby, that rejected that and held expressly that even settlement with the underlying carrier, if it's not for the full amount of policy limits, does not trigger the excess coverage. Even if Coppers were to apply, it only applies when there is a settlement with the underlying policyholder because of the policy of wanting to promote settlement, and that doesn't apply here. Secondly, they say this court should rewrite the policy. It expressly provides.
How many do you have, Counselor, because you're out of time?
I guess I'm.
You're on your, no, you're on your second. Do you have more than two?
Three, I think.
I have three.
Give me two. Give me the second one.
And then this isn't very long, is it? The second one, I want to rewrite the policy. The federal access policy expressly defines the underlying insurance as the national union policy with the number that's at stake in this case. Comcast wants you to rewrite it and say, ignore what the language says, and construe it to mean either paid under that policy or any other policy national union might have issued to a different company. But that's not what the policy says.
Thank you, Counsel. Add a minute to Mr. Lowe's time. We can't be totally equal, but we'll come close.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the even-handed treatment. I want to start by responding to an argument that Mr. McFadden made when he was responding to a question from Judge Gabriel about the inception date. And he said, well, you know, they could have negotiated a deal where there was language in there about the inception date, but they didn't, so it has to be construed against them. He's got it 180 degrees backwards. The principle in Pennsylvania is that if the insurer could have written it in a clearer way, then that is an ambiguity, and that in itself is construed against the insurer. And so here, of course, there's evidence that the insurer had the language right there in the subsidiary definition, which it didn't use. And we acknowledge that if they had put that in the NHO provision, and if we had agreed to it, that would have resolved the ambiguity. But they didn't use it, and under Pennsylvania law, that's on their head, not ours. They cannot be heard to point at us and say, well, you guys didn't negotiate clearer language. Not acceptable under Pennsylvania law.
Mr. Lowe, how do you respond to Mr. McDonald's arguments that the subsidiary clause and the MHO clause are just structured differently? You need the cease to be a sub-language because it talks about on or before inception, and that's different.
Well, because it doesn't make any difference that there's additional language that says on or before inception, because that's already in the MHO provision. If the MHO provision is written so that if a company is an MHO due to the 5% level, either before or on the inception date, then on the first day of coverage, the first day of the policy, it's an MHO. So either way, it's either a subsidiary under the subsidiary provision or it's an MHO under the MHO provision. And what they're saying is, well, we needed the cessation language as to subsidiaries, because if we didn't have it, the subsidiary would go on and would continually, perpetually be a subsidiary forever because there was no cessation language. And we say exactly. Because there's no doubt that on day one of the of this three-year period that At Home was, in fact, an MHO. And there's no cessation language. And so under their own reasoning, it goes right ahead, and for the entire policy period, it remains an MHO because there is no language stating otherwise. So we like that chain of reasoning that they've used.
excuse me. I'd like to then turn briefly to the arguments made by Mr. Ingebrigtsen about this exhaustion requirement. You may have noticed that I only devoted a paragraph in my brief, my reply brief, to that argument. You know, I just can't see why they think that has any merit. We started with a $25 million limit for National Union, and what they're saying is that it's not $25 million if we get $3.6 million first from National Union plus $22.4 million. In my book, that adds up to $25 million cash money on the barrelhead. And if we win this case and get that $22.4, we will have gotten $25 million from National Union. Now, he argues, oh, no, that $3.6 million, that was under a different policy, so that money still remains under this policy? Absolutely not. The policy provides that because the reason it's credited is because the policy provides that monies under other policies that cover the same risk are they reduce the limit. So the limit under the policy is reduced from 25 to 22.4 is one way to look at it. But I can assure you that if after they paid the remaining 22.4, so they've now paid 25 total, if we were to have a new problem, a new claim were to come in from this period, and we were to say, okay, we have $3.6 million worth of coverage left under this National Union policy, they would have laughed at us. So
if we win, we get $25 million. That's all we're asking for. We credit them for the $3.6 they've already paid. Thank you very much.
We want to thank counsel for their briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.